Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist, and I'd like to welcome you to our show today. This is show number 11, Sensory Issues in Language-Delayed Toddlers and Young Preschoolers. And we're going to continue the conversation that we had last week, where we started to introduce sensory issues and talk about why those were important. You know, one thing we didn't talk about last week is to give you kind of a general description of what it's like to live with a sensory disorder. So I want to read to you a quote. This is from author Stanley Greenspan, who is a very recognized person in the field of child development. And let me read you just this description that he says that will help us understand what people experience when they can't effectively process or interpret sensory input. He says, imagine that you're driving a car that isn't working very well. When you step on the gas, the car sometimes lurches forward and sometimes it doesn't respond at all. When you blow the horn, it sounds blaring, or again, it may not work at all. The brakes sometimes slow the car, but not always. The blinkers work occasionally. The steering is erratic and the speedometer is inaccurate. You are engaged in a constant struggle to keep a car on the road, and it's difficult to concentrate on anything else. And his point is with this that children with sensory processing disorders feel out of control. They feel like they're in their bodies, but they can't always make them work or predict how things will happen. So feeling that out of control all the time, I think it would be really disconcerting. Kate, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay. Okay, good. Well, we're talking about sensory disorders today, like we were last week, sensory processing disorders. And I read that quote from Stanley Greenspan. Had you read that before or heard that before?
I'm sure I have, because I've read Greenspan pretty well, but I don't recall it. But I think it also kind of points out the varying the way that sometimes kids' sensory issues seem really huge and other times it's not so noticeable. Just like he was saying, sometimes the brakes work and sometimes they don't. That's the way sensory kids are. They're highly unpredictable. Sometimes it seems very obvious, sometimes it doesn't.
Right. And I think that's confusing to parents too. Or it might be, especially it seems more confusing sometimes to even dads. Because they'll say, he's not like that all the time. I don't know where you're getting this fancy name for this, but, you know, that's not a problem all the time. When I tell him to sit down and calm down, he really can do it. And then the mom, you know, just kind of rolls her eyes and says, well, it's not so easy. That's not as it's not all about behavior, or that, you know, it's somehow the mom's fault because she can't control them enough. So I do think that's an important point to consider, is that sometimes with any neurological disorder, or, you know, just being wired differently, there are going to be times that are variable. Sometimes you can hold it all together and things work pretty well, and then sometimes they are completely falling apart. We apparently are having some kind of emergency in downtown Shelbyville. Can you hear all the sirens?
No. Uh-uh.
Okay. You probably will in a second. Sorry about that background noise there. All right.
Starting to, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the things that you and I said last week when we finished the show. We had a conversation about wanting to be sure that we mentioned that one of the reasons that it's so important that parents identify sensory processing disorders in their children is that it just makes them more aware of how their child feels and how their child really struggles. And in my experience as a therapist, I've found, and as a parent, when I can empathize with a kid and when I can understand that this is something that's happening that he doesn't have complete control of, it does make me a little more sensitive to the things that are going on instead of just, again, blaming it on behavior or acting like he chooses purposefully to make himself not like certain sounds or textures, or that he's choosing just to be a little wild kid running around, crashing and banging all the time, not that it's something that's out of his control. Were you going to talk about that a little bit, Kate?
I think additionally, not only does it give you a little bit of insight and perhaps empathy into what may be challenging behaviors or even just quirky behaviors, I think it also kind of helps parents, and I know both of us as therapists kind of predict perhaps what their response will be, and
right.
also what they may tend to like, because if they are seekers, if they're looking for visual feedback or auditory or tactile, then we kind of sometimes play to that and think, what sort of thing is going to be enticing for this child? So not only does it help parents realize that it's not necessarily a choice their child's making, but what kinds of things is Johnny going to like, because they have some insight, you know, kind of helps them predict unpredictable behavior, if that's, because that makes any sense, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, we have to remember with children with, even typically developing children, and especially children with sensory processing disorders, and we talked about last week all the different things that that could look like, and that you may have several children of your own, three or four, and two of them may have sensory issues, and then, but they may not look anything alike. You know, each child's profile is different. So what you have to do is look for, again, you can use the things that they like and the things that they crave to entice them to do situations, and then the things that they avoid, we can also learn to use them a little bit too. Let me get back to what I was going to say. Talking about every child being different, and there are so many different requirements, and what we have to do as parents is really look at what they're doing, what they're telling us, and the only way that we know how, which is by observing their behaviors, and then we take what they already do and make it safer. And I think that was your point about, I completely lost my train of thought. I'm so sorry. That was
okay.
The point about looking at what they already do and make it safer, or make it in a way that would be acceptable socially. And so that would be the beginning. And the way that OTs talk about all of this is they call this developing a sensory diet for your child. And again, it doesn't mean certain foods they eat. It's not talking about diet in the way that you eat. It's talking about setting up a set of activities throughout the day so that your child can use these activities to either help them calm down or help them not be as sensitive to things that they're processing, or the other way, help them participate a little bit better.
Yeah, don't always see parents or even therapists suggest it this way, but I do think if parents are aware of their child's sensory issues and they kind of anticipate and work that into their daily schedule, it can just make for a much more peaceful day and peaceful coexistence, because it's kind of like if you don't provide something that's acceptable that's going to meet their need, they're going to probably find something that's going to be less acceptable and perhaps dangerous or terribly messy or, you know, somehow a problem. So works very well. And I like as a therapist to work them into, or a lot of times if I can, and parents able to kind of get a child ready even before I get there, because I don't want a child to be able to sit and focus for as long as possible. And, you know, we work with young kids that might not be long, but if they have some kids, if they haven't been prepared, and Laura, I know you do this too, if a parent's willing and able to, you'll say, hey, could you have your child or help your child to do these things before I get there so that they're kind of primed and ready? Because if
right.
they don't, we spend so much of our hour doing those things. Not that it's not pleasant, it is, but then they're not able to do the sit and focus activities that we are trying to get them to do. So they're great for that. They can also be great for getting ready to go to bed, getting ready to take a nap, you know, those kinds of things.
Going to a restaurant with the
right,
fancy.
If you know your kids can be stuck in the high chair or whatever, you know, by necessity, you might say, well, I'm not going to just take them in there and sit them down because it's going to be awful. But if you prepare the child with using that sensory diet, then it can make for a much nicer outing. So
yeah. So let's talk about how that would look. Let's take kind of a sample child. Let's first of all do a child that's a sensory seeker, or if one that's kind of under-responsive, one that really, really likes the movement, who really wants everything go all the time. So that kind of kid. Let's talk about some activities that a parent might include in his sensory diet. And we were having this conversation earlier, Kate, and you were just mentioning it now. If we have a kid who's constantly on the go and that we know that he wants to sit, what we might do is we might ask a parent to get him ready by having him go jump on the bed for 10 minutes before we get there and really play with him and roughhouse him and tickle him and let him move. If I have a kid that a parent hasn't gotten to do that before I get there, I might just play chase with them for a good 5 or 10 minutes so that we are really running all through the house and I'm picking them up and I'm slamming them down on the couch. I'm giving them all that movement and all that sensory input. And again, so that the end result would be that they would be able to sit and work with me for the time that we need to do speech therapy. If I notice during a therapy session that a kid is kind of out of control and kind of fidgety, I might then introduce an activity so that he can get that movement. Like we might play balloons or we might pop bubbles where we're both standing up and I'm blowing them and saying, reach up, get them, jump, reach. Or, you know, when we're popping the bubbles, I might make a really exaggerated movement so that we're popping them on the floor with our hands, or we might stand up and stomp on those bubbles. You have that great toy, Kate, Skydancer. Where you might, or a launcher, or I have a rocket shooter that I'm using right now, where I might shoot the rocket and shoot it just as far as I can and then say, run, so that we're giving the kid the opportunity to really work that movement activity into what we're doing. And knowing that if we do that kind of activity for 5 or 10 minutes, then he's going to be able to sit down and sit through the next 10 or 15 minutes, hopefully. Sometimes it's not quite that long. But sit down and then do that sit-down activity that we want to do. I tell parents to do that kind of thing. They know that they're about to go to a restaurant, and before you go in, while Dad goes in to get their name in the with the hostess, Mom might stand out there and have the kid jump up and down out of the van, you know, 25 times. You know, climb back up on to the ledge and then jump off and over so that they can really get that sensory input that they need before they would go into that situation.
Yeah, other at home ones I like, or I sometimes suggest or even use if it's one of those days when I just can't seem to hold the child's attention or he's so fidgety that he can't, you know, stay with me, is I like the either make a swing out of a blanket, or sometimes I use like those little collapsible, well, they call them laundry baskets, but they're just mesh bags with handles.
Uh-huh.
You can put them in there and swing them, or swing them in the blanket, or I like slide on the steps because they're getting all that deep pressure. Their little bottoms as they're boom, boom, boom,
all the way
and
down.
If you have steps, they can do it. Sometimes I'll suggest that you use a soft blanket underneath, but most boys are happy to just kind of crash all the way down those steps. Not that girls don't like that sometimes too, but like Laura says, any kind of repetitive, heavy, you know, if they have a trampoline, hey, great. Can we get them on there for 10 minutes before we get before I arrive, or before you need to go and do something where you know your child is going to be pretty much contained? Then that's a great way to get them prepared to be able to sit and be pleasant. So,
right, and be able to function and do that. Other kinds of sensory-seeking things that we see all the time would be kids who, again, want to mouth off toys. You want everything to go in their mouth. And parents might say this too, gosh, you know, she puts everything in her mouth. She tries to eat everything. So then what you would want to do as your sensory diet solution would be to give that kid more appropriate things to mouth. More whistles, more birthday horns, more chewy toys. And really, again, the theory is because she has opportunities to do that you've set for her that are safe, she's not going to need to do that as much when you're trying to play with an activity.
Yeah, and you're talking about kids who are, I think, Laura, you always say 2 is about the age when kids typically stop putting so much in their mouths, and I think a lot of kids do it even before that. You know, we're not talking babies who are supposed to stick everything in their mouths, but kids who are really kind of should be beyond that stage as far as their age goes, but yet that's kind of their preference. For you give them some toy, a shape disorder or a whatever, a car, and it goes in their mouths, and really that's kind of what they're all about, is stick it in their mouth. And so using the sensory diet theory, like Laura said, providing all those oral things for them to do. Some kids, like I've suggested, to let a child have a vibrating toothbrush, because that's
right.
good feedback, and that's supposed to go in their mouth, so that's that's an okay thing, better than every dirty toy they find in the toy box or in my bag, or, you know, so it's kind of acknowledging, yep, he seems to need that feedback at this point, so we're going to provide it.
Absolutely. You know, let's talk about, since you brought up toothbrushing and we were talking about mouthing, let's talk about kids who are kind of on the other end of that, kids who don't want toothbrushes in their mouths, or kids who are really defensive in that way. There's an article on the website at teachmetotalk.com that lists some different ideas for toothbrushing for toddlers. And not wanting to brush their teeth, again, is a sensory issue a lot of times with a kid, because they are overreactive. Sometimes it can be fixed with just a parent taking a less aversive approach. You know, I'll say, a lot of times I'll say to mom, well, why don't you show me kind of what you do, and let's talk about some strategies that you could use that might get a kid really prepared for that. And sometimes it's as simple as really kind of setting routine to be, or part of your routine to include toothbrushing, so that the kid knows what to expect. I had a little girl a few years back that I talk about all the time. Her name is Layla, and she was so tactfully defensive. She had all kinds of feeding problems. But one of the things that her mom did with her toothbrush is really started to kind of play with the toothbrush with her before she was ready to brush her teeth. And one of the things that she would do is get character toothbrushes, and she might have them hop up her arm. And talk about Dora's hopping, she's jumping, here she comes. And she would get it all the way up to her arm, and then all the way on her shoulder, and then on her chest, and then up on her chin, and then hop around on her lips for a few minutes. And then Layla would be desensitized enough to let her mom brush her teeth. That would be one idea. Sometimes it's letting your kid brush for a little while and get his mouth kind of warmed up and get him ready, and then you can take over after that, because it's made him less sensitive when you've given him some control over that. One thing I did with my own children is not let toothbrushing be the single activity. They could brush their teeth while they were taking a bath, and sometimes doing another activity while they're brushing their teeth, or if they're a video kid, if you're going to let them watch a video, so you can watch that, but you have to brush your teeth while you do it. That might be another way to do that. Kate, you had a kid who had a hard time brushing his teeth a few months ago. What kinds of things worked for that mom?
I think she ended up doing it in the bathtub.
Yeah.
Because he loved his bath, and if she worked it into the bath time routine, he was far less defensive and combative, whereas if she tried to do it right before bed, it was just a horrible, some kids can just absolutely hate having, my kids seemed to always love having, at least they loved to brush their own teeth. They didn't necessarily, but I kind of did what you talked about, where you let them do it, and then, okay, mommy or daddy, whomever, finished, so that we made sure it was really done right, because two-year-olds like to brush their teeth, but they don't really get back where they need to get and all that good stuff, so it's nice to let them start. But anyway, I think she worked it into the bath time routine, and, you know, I think key there is then that kind of needs to be the end of food or anything to drink except water, which sometimes, but maybe the video thing for that is the way to go. If they're going to watch Dora right before they go to bed anyway, then...
Then they have to brush their teeth so that they can watch, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have a kid on my caseload right now whose mom tells them right before they go anywhere, and she makes a big deal about, you know, he likes to go to preschool, he likes to go swimming, likes to do all these things, and she says, oh, you know, and she doesn't make him brush his teeth until after he's put on his shoes and he's so excited about going. That's how she uses it. You know, first we're going to brush our teeth, then... we get to go swim, or then we get to go do whatever, and that always seems to make it easier for her, too, because he's looking forward to that next activity rather than fighting her on the toothbrushing. One other thing that might be a problem with toothbrushing sometimes is the taste of the toothpaste.
If you have a kid that's really sensitive, you might not even want to use the toothpaste with that. You might just try water or try to find a toothpaste that's really, some of those baby toothpastes, I think, are a lot less overpowering than some of the adult toothpaste. So you might want to try that too. One other thing that I think has worked for parents is if the mom is always fighting with the kid to brush their teeth, you might try have dad doing it. Just sometimes the change in person, and dad might make it a little bit more fun than mom has, and then that even would turn into a treat if for a kid if he felt like, oh, you know, daddy's going to do this with me, this is a different way to do it. And again, you don't get into the whole power struggle thing.
I do seem to have quite a few kids on my caseload that you know, don't tend to fight dad quite as much, not necessarily always relative to toothbrushing, but just general things, you know, behaviors they're trying to get them to do. They're not as, they don't tend to push or fight back with dad quite as much. Sometimes I wonder, now, why is that? But they don't, you know. I think they're always so comfortable with their mothers that they really, really know how to turn it on for mommy. But yeah, that's a good one. Sometimes if dad does it, he says, oh, dad's doing it. Must be cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Or mm-hmm. dad, again, you know, it just might not be a power struggle. You know, they might
mm-hmm.
just get into that routine that this is what I do. I fight mommy tooth and nail. Daddy wants to do it. It's just enough of a change that it's fun that they want to do it. One idea, you talked about the battery-powered toothbrush for kids who like sensation. There are some kids that are a little scared of that at the beginning. So sometimes I recommend that maybe parents, instead of putting new batteries in that toothbrush, might steal batteries from the remote control or from a favorite toy so that the toothbrush is not going to be quite so overpowering at the beginning. That might be a way to introduce a battery-powered toothbrush for a kid who's a little scared of that. I've had kids kind of scared of that before. Have you?
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of say, well, let them hold them, let them play with it, let them brush
yeah.
the baby doll's teeth, let them kind of desensitize the rest of their body before they even think about sticking it in their mouth, yeah.
Yeah. You might have your kid, too, try to brush your teeth. Let him brush your teeth for a little while and then trade, you know, kind of take turns that way where then you are going to brush his teeth. And so it becomes kind of that turn-taking thing. I, a long time ago, let a little girl brush my teeth in therapy. I will not do that again. Let me just get that from a therapist. She nearly killed me. But that would be a good idea for a kid. I think that would be novel enough, too, to kind of break that cycle a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
They would think that was kind of cool. Okay, so we talked about toothbrushing as kind of a common sensory aversion that some kids have. Let's go back and talk about some things that we might do for a kid who might be tactily defensive that we might want to do therapy-wise for him. Okay, in a kid that would mean that he's hypersensitive, he over responds to touch. So these would be the kids that really want to avoid anything being on their hands. They almost act scared or freak out, you know, when they see a little piece of glue or that food's gotten on their hands. These are kids that are constantly, you know, wanting their mom to get it off, you know, screaming about that. What are some things, let's talk about some things therapy-wise that we might want to do with them. I always start with just things that seem like they're going to be really, really fun. Like Play-Doh usually works pretty well, and I like to use Play-Doh with kids that are like this, again, because you can use all of the cutters and the rollers, and so kids don't actually have to touch it at the beginning to play. So that might be a good idea for them.
Yeah, what was I going to say? I was going to say that one thing with touch, I think, is interesting and kind of counterintuitive to me somehow, but it seems to be fairly common, is that kids are oftentimes more sensitive to what the OTs and other therapists like to call light touch and
yeah.
Less sensitive to deep or heavy touch.
Right.
And if you think about if you took your finger and ran it along the child's arm or lightly on his face or almost in a loving, sweet, you know, just a slight touch, that can be really, what would be the right word to call it, Laura? Uncomfortable or almost painful or
somehow
unpleasant.
Yeah, they feel like that it's been totally unpleasant. Yeah.
Yeah, and that to me is interesting. I'm not sure I understand why it is. I just know that a lot of kids who have tactile sensitivities, they're more sensitive to the light touch than they are, in fact, the deep pressure. My little anecdote on that is I had this cute little guy in southern Indiana years ago, and he really hated his bath, and he was, I saw mostly for really speech kinds of things, but as he made progress, his mother at one point told me that he hated his bath and he hated the washcloth, and I kind of said to her, you know, try doing that harder. You know, I know that seems strange, but don't, you know, especially if your child hates it, I think it's very natural for a mom to think, well, it must kind of hurt. I'll do it lighter, you know, because, that's what she was doing, which seemed to make sense. Right,
yeah.
And he freaked out, hated it. And as he, you know, got some words and was able to express himself verbally, at one point he told her, hurt, Mommy.
Oh.
Yeah, it was so sweet. I know he was the cutest guy. But he did respond well to that. If she took the wash, and I don't mean rub his skin off, but, you know, she was getting lighter and lighter and lighter instead of really kind of giving him a good rub, and that he tolerated pretty well. So, anyway, that's just kind of a little... on this tactile front, remember that. It's a weird thing, but sometimes it's the case. So, anyway, wanted to get that out.
Yeah, and that's a good example. Other things that OTs might try with those kinds of kids are to get their whole bodies ready before they do that activity. So, again, this might be letting a kid run around and really kind of get his system going, and then try that sort of play so that, again, you're getting his body more able to tolerate that first. I had a whole list of those kinds of activities. Can you hear me flipping through paper? Because I'm really trying to find it. I can't find it. More of those ideas that talk about kinds of tactile play that we might introduce. You know, those kinds of things are, those kinds of experiences are also sometimes really important for kids who are picky eaters, because sometimes that goes together, that they are so sensitive about things in their mouth that they're also a little bit sensitive about things on their hands. So we get them used to exploring those different textures with their hands, and then they do a little bit better with it with feeding. That's why for feeding therapy, lots of that therapy isn't really about eating. It's about getting the child accustomed to the texture of the food. So for pudding, you might put the pudding on the high chair and play with that, which is absolutely disgusting to some moms' sense of cleanliness. Oh, here it is. Thank goodness. So you might do that as even a part of feeding therapy. Okay, other things that besides Play-Doh that you might do for kids. Silly putty is a good one. And I think I like silly putty better because you can't really smell it, and it doesn't seem to be, it's just kind of a little bit slicker feel. So some kids might do that, like that a little bit better than Play-Doh. Shaving cream, did we already talk about that?
The other one with that is, and I've seen some daycares do this, some of these are kind of messy and parents don't always love them, but they really are great activities, whipped cream. So if they're you know, likely to stick their hands in their mouths, oh, well, they got a little whipped cream instead of shaving cream, which some kids won't stick their hands in their mouth, so they're fine with shaving cream. But if they're still putting those hands in their mouths, the whipped cream might be an option on that one.
Yeah, that's a good idea. The goos or the xyrofoam, those are the things that you can find on that Play-Doh aisle, too. Other kinds of tactile experiences that OTs might do with these kids might be filling up a little Rubbermaid container with beans or rice. You know, and that's going to be uncooked, of course, but you would use those and hide little plastic characters in there and have them find them. And, again, if a kid doesn't want to touch it, you might use a shovel or a little spoon to let them really get accustomed to digging around in it before they would want to put their fingers or their hands in it.
Yeah, Laura, you talked about that with, the Play-Doh, using the utensils. And I think with all these things, if your child is hypersensitive to it, you never want to just say, okay, you know,
right.
You hate Play-Doh, bam, here goes a big wad in your hand. Or you hate the feel of those beans, and you stick them in there. You always kind of want to introduce it, keep it as playful and fun, kind of activity-driven, but also let them kind of approach it at their own pace so that you're not making what is already sensitive even more sensitive. You got to let them do it kind of as they're comfortable with it. And most kids do, in fact, get beyond a lot of these things, but it's at their pace. You know, parents introduce it, and kids kind of accept it at their own pace. So,
right, that slow, gradual introduction is important. You already talked about not forcing them. And this, again, would be, that happens with feeding so much. A kid has a real feeding aversion, a real feeding issue, and somebody comes in and decides, well, it's just because somebody hasn't made him do it yet. So they're trying to force feed him and make him do it. That never, ever, ever works. So if you see that your kid has a really significant fearful response, you are going to want to go really slow and, again, gradually help him tolerate those changes. You know, I meant to, at the beginning of the show today, talk about just kind of those general treatment guidelines, and I got this great suggestion. This was from the website that we talked about last week. It's www.sensory-processing-disorder.com, and it has just tons of information for parents on there about sensory processing disorders. And the treatment guidelines, it talked about, again, it uses the same mode that we talked about last week, our over-responders, the kids that are hypersensitive, that overreact to things. And it the list starts with the things we just talked about. You want to do a slow, gradual introduction. You don't want to force the kid to do anything, to move, to taste, or to touch things, which would cause that fearful response. You're going to prepare the child and let him know ahead of time what you're doing and while you're engaged in the activity or treatment, so you're not going to surprise it on them or surprise them with it or throw it on them. You know, you're going to let them always know what's coming next. You want to allow the child to experience sensations when he's ready. You're going to encourage him and creatively find a way to get him to do it. You let the child know by your actions and by your words that you understand and accept what he's feeling, and you are patient. You allow extra time, and if the child is verbal, you ask them to talk about how they're feeling. Most of the kids, of course, that we see wouldn't be able to do that, but you gave that great example of that little boy saying, hurt, talking about how his mom was trying to wash his face. Aww. So those were some treatment guidelines for the hypersensitive children, the ones that do overreact to sensory input. And I think I gave this example last week. I have a little guy that startles a lot when we play in therapy with toys. And so I know that if we're going to do a balloon or a ball that pops, a toy that might scare him in some ways, I might hold him before we even start to play with it, because deep pressure to him is calming. And he does seem to respond less fearfully, and he's less reactive to that, and he's more likely to want to go ahead and play when I'm holding him rather than when he's just sitting by himself to do it. Okay, let's move on and talk about the other end of treatment guidelines for hyposensitive children. These are the ones that underreact to sensory input, and so these are the ones that would be our sensory seekers. And so what we want to do is help make the child aware of his body parts through heavy work, input, and sensory play. And again, the theory is that these kids don't normally process the movement or process the incoming sounds or the vision, the visual things. And so they seek more, 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 more. And so what we want to do is help make their little systems more aware of those things. Those kinds of children get older, you do want to teach them language to understand their own sensory needs. So one thing that I do with these kinds of kids, if I have a kid who likes to spin, guess what? I'm working on that word so that he's able to tell his parents that. You know, if they have a spinny chair in their house, boy, I use that a lot. Kate, we were talking earlier about sit and spins,
mm-hmm.
How good those are for those kinds of kids. You know, and spin might be one of the verbs, or, you know, we might even come up with our own sign for that so that they, again, are using words that they can request. Things that make their little bodies feel better. Those are the kids that we talked about before that we're going to give them as many movement experiences and as many movement breaks as that we could in the course of therapy. And if I were a mom of a kid like that, I would make sure that we never had a 3 or 4 hour period in a day where he didn't get a lot of opportunities to really get up and really play. Those would be the kinds of kids that if I would have them outside unless it were during a hurricane, I think I would, if it were cold, I'd bundle them up and have them out. If it were hot, you know, we'd play in the sprinkler. Those are the kids who need to move and who need to be outside and who need lots of those different kinds of activities.
I was just going to say, I think that's a big one that moms aren't always real comfortable with being outside so much or getting their kids outside, but you know, in modern society, I think in general, kids don't necessarily get the outside time that they need, not only kids who are hyposensitive to tactile stuff, but just kids in general. You know, I mean, I think that all those sensory things are enriched when kids are outside and exploring and running and jumping and moving and all those cool things. But certainly those kids who need a lot of movement outside is a great place for them to be so that they can swing and jump and do all the normal, you know, ride their scooters and bikes. But important.
Even if they're, you know, not old enough to ride bikes and stuff, just to be out in the yard and to, you know, go up and down the steps and, you know, find something for them to climb up and jump off and, you know, just those roll around on the grass, you know, all those kinds of experiences are important for that. One thing that she says, too, for treatment guidelines for the hyposensitive children, again, the children who underreact to input, who really, really crave it, would be to have the child do activities in a variety of positions. And so you think about, you know, sometimes when we want to play with kids, we just think about them sitting and being on their bottoms. You might have them try to, you know, maybe do the puzzle when they're laying flat on their bellies and, you know, propped up on their elbows. Or you might have them, again, sit on a therapy ball or sit, it doesn't even have to be a therapy ball, you know, sit on a ball. Do something that would change their position a little bit so that they're going to get that feedback. I like to use beanbag chairs with kids like that because they can feel where they are. And, again, they get a little bit more of that oomph and they're going to give them more of that feedback so that they can sit with me for a little while longer.
Yep. She also talks about the heavy work. And those suggestions, the ones I always use or kind of routinely use are if they're in the house, is, you know, get them to help you carry the grocery bags to the kitchen or load up a little shopping cart with heavy things and have them push that around the house or the laundry basket full of clothes. You know, if he can pull it along or push it along back to the bedroom, enlist his services. And it doesn't really matter if he dumps it or crashes it into the wall. Anything he's doing where he's or she is getting a lot of kind of heavy movement, deep pressure in their joints is great for them. Or, you know, he's probably or she's going to find something that isn't so great. You know?
Yeah, and that's
from the dining room chandelier, perhaps.
Yeah, and that's the thing is you want to look at what your kids are doing and figure out, okay, that must be the input that he or she needs. How can I help him do that in a safer way? And so, again, that website, I just can't say enough good things about it. It's
it really is good.
I'm
impressed with it. They give great examples, and they put it in terms that make a lot of sense, I think, to not just OTs, but normal people who, you know, parents and other therapists could look at the site and learn a lot.
I think, yeah, I think so too. It's been the most parent-friendly website that I've found for OT kinds of things.
Right.
I think she's a therapist after my own heart with, let's put this in real words that people can, or, and especially parents, can look at and understand. She's got a great article, the heavy work activities article. She's great. You've already mentioned that. But it gives experiences. Other gross motor activities that she suggests for that would be having kids have a backpack on. And OTs that I've worked with for a long time have suggested that. Kids who really can benefit from that deep pressure all the time, you might let them wear a little backpack. And even if they were having a hard time holding it together in the grocery store, because they want to run and, you know, do all kinds of things that you don't want to do, that might be what you have them do is fill up their backpack with some books. Or sometimes, a long time ago, therapists would suggest cans of vegetables. Mm-hmm. And then I think they realized, ooh, that's a little bit too heavy.
Well, for fat kids, it's okay. Marjorie, remember our little backpack kid who was having doing pretty well at home but continued to have some sensory issues that were kind of disrupting his ability to, you know, go to preschool and do that without difficulty, and a backpack was suggested for him, and he liked it so much he didn't want to take it off the whole time he was at preschool. He just walked around with his heavy little backpack.
You know, and if I were a preschool teacher, I would just let him keep it on all day. Who cares?
Oh, because with that, he was kind of able to participate and, you know, follow the little routines and wasn't pushing kids around anymore and wasn't, you know, doing all these disruptive things. And so, it didn't matter. I just thought it was funny that he liked it so much. That was it.
He wanted to keep it on.
And it certainly was better than the alternative. So that was a good solution for him. And 2-year-olds don't really care if kids wear backpacks or not. So,
I know. And I do think if an OT is listening to this, I'm sure they're probably saying, okay, the kid's going to habituate to the backpack. You don't really want to let them wear it all the time. They're going to get too used to it, and you won't have that therapeutic results anymore. And I'm just teasing about that. So, OTs, you don't have to call or write me. I do understand the difference. You want to let them wear it to help them calm down, and if it looks like it's, you know, if it's been on a good 20 or 30 minutes, you want to take it off. Sometimes OTs, when you have a child that's in OT, they might suggest the weighted vest or, you know, even any kind of, like, to help them sleep, a weighted blanket, a weighted lap pad to help them sit. Again, those are more technical or more therapeutic methods of doing the same thing, of helping your kid achieve that deep pressure.
Those, what are they called, Theratogs or whatever, where those are kind of like bodysuit things. But, you know, I've also heard OTs suggest for kids just to wear like a tight leotard, just like a little ballet.
Yeah, a tight onesie that's almost a size too small. Yeah.
Right, underneath, and then, you know, nobody knows they have it on, but somehow that makes them get that deep pressure and just kind of calms them and allows them to kind of follow the routine, whatever that might be, a little bit easier. And, you know, what a simple thing. Find an old gymnastic suit or leotard at a garage sale for a quarter, and hey, no big deal.
You're in business.
Yeah.
Great. Other gross motor activities, and I do this a lot with kids, is play tug of war and let them really pull, or they might, you talked about lugging the grocery bag. I let them, if I have kids that are really, I need that kind of input, I might even have them pull my therapy bag from one part of their house to another. That's the same kind of
kids love that, don't they? I mean,
they
little
love
boys,
it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I'll say it's heavy, and they're, but just love the bag. Until, of course, they're at the age where it's not a problem, and then they're not so enthusiastic about it. But when they're two, that's a cool thing to do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When we had Michelle on a couple of weeks ago talking about muscle tone and low muscle tone, you know, she suggested wheelbarrow walking. That would be another activity that would be a way for kids to get that extra input throughout their bodies. I have pretended, especially when I was in my 30s, I used to do this more, pretend to be a snake, something on the floor, and, you know, crawl around, you know, on their belly on the floor. That gives you lots of kind of all over input. I haven't done that one lately. Other things, again, might be using just your playground equipment so that they can climb and hang on and get their even that feeling through their little arms, through their muscles. I have lots of kids through the youth whose parents have had such good luck with doing little gymnastics classes or going to little programs like that because their kids then get that physical activity within the context of a little class. Do you have lots of kids that do that, Kate, little classes?
Not really too many, but it's great if, you know, if it's available and parents can afford it. Not necessarily, you know, a real structured, they're going to teach them how to do a cartwheel, but just movement activities that are appropriate for, because we see such young kids. But, yeah, kids
right.
just love that.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. And then you have kids then that they start to learn about how their bodies work, and then, you know, they get to be older, and those are the kinds of kids that might, you know, kind of become addicted, quote-unquote, to running because it makes them feel so good. Those kinds of kids might, as they get older, you know, really, even if they're not that athletically inclined, love to play soccer, love to do those kinds of things because of how regulated their little bodies feel after they do all that heavy work. So even if you don't think you have a champion, an Olympian at your house, those kinds of little activities are good to do.
If it keeps them happy, then it's a good activity, yeah. So many of them are pretty physical and lend themselves to that outside piece, or at least the movement, you know.
Yeah.
So, gotta get them moving, get them outside.
Yeah, I think so, too. Okay, let's talk about when you think your child needs to see an occupational therapist. I meant to do this at the beginning, too. We're kind of going backwards today. But we were talking about this earlier. I think the guideline should be, you know, if you have a kid that's a late talker, and a lot of our kids have already been evaluated through our state's early intervention program, so they've already had kind of an overall developmental assessment before we get them, but maybe there are parents listening who have children who are late talkers that they don't have them enrolled in any kind of therapy yet, and they're thinking, oh, my kid has some of these things. I just thought it was the way he is. You know, should I get an OT assessment? What would be some indicators? I think if you have a child whose behaviors make him, and behaviors with an S, so that he has 3 or 4 or 10 or, you know, lots of different things that you're concerned about, these kinds of behaviors that you've talked about, that we've talked about over the last 2 weeks, that would be when I would think, okay, I might need some professional help with this. If you are noticing that it's more than just a little quirky thing or two, you know, it's lots of different issues, and if those issues make him really seem different than other children his age, you need to go ahead and pursue an occupational therapy assessment. What are some things, Kate, that you see that you encourage parents of your little clients, when do you encourage them to go ahead and get an assessment, make that referral?
Specific behaviors? I mean, I don't know that there's one that I would say, oh, got to get the OT. I think it's a kind of preponderance of evidence sort of thing. One, just, you know, I guess by the time I'm seeing them, we've already established that there is some kind of developmental delay, maybe communication,
right.
Probably some cognitive portion, maybe social, you know, these things kind of, when kids have sensory issues or even when they don't, but kids who are delayed, they tend to have some issues in a variety of areas, probably the least so with Laura might see a child who is really just language delayed. They're just a late talker. But oftentimes your kids have other things as well. I guess it's when I see a child that has some sensory issues, and I said last week, I think all kids have some sensory issues. It's a matter of, are these sensory issues playing into the child's experiences or routines to the extent that they are either, well, basically in one way or another, because they're overly sensitive or not very sensitive, that they really don't participate in things the way that typical kids do. And that might
right.
be because they're bouncing off the walls so much that they couldn't possibly sit and complete a puzzle, you know, or
right.
it might be because they are so preoccupied at looking at things, getting some visual feedback, that they really aren't able to respond to things that they hear. Or, you know, so if it's really disrupting a child from just experiencing things in their homes or in their daily outings, then I would say, because it really does kind of hinder them from developing typically, if these things are such an issue that they can't really get through the day doing things that kids are typically able to do. I don't know if that's clear enough. kind of blah, blah, blah. If it just gets to a point where I think, okay, this is keeping me really from making the progress I'd like to be able to make, and I think this child's capable of making, but just not without that sensory piece being met, then I say,
I think we need to talk about OT.
Go ahead.
Well,
Sarah.
And I think for the parents that would be the kind of parent who were going to who was going to listen to this broadcast, if you've been on the internet and you've read some things and you tried some things and you think, gosh, I'm still, these really basic ideas aren't getting as much success, that would be a time where you might think, gosh, we need to go ahead and call an OT in to really look and see. And I think the best thing that I read when I'm doing all this research for these sensory shows has been that you really want to tackle these kinds of issues before a child turns 7, because that's the time when your neurological system is most likely to be able to change. It's malleable. It's at this point, when a child is really, really young, that you're going to be able to kind of rewire him so that he is able to tolerate these things and he is able to participate. And waiting much longer while OT or any kind of treatment may be successful, it's just going to take as long or take longer to do, and it just is not going to be as helpful overall to him developmentally than if he had done it really early.
Okay, as the DI on the podcast, Laura, I have to put a little quick note in here. One thing is, when I go to daycares or preschools to see young children with, who are receiving therapy, I'm always the most impressed with preschool programs or daycares that allow kids to, or encourage and provide for kids, lots of sensory experiences.
Right.
The bins with the beans and the sand tables and the water tables and just a little nature table that may have pine cones and all of normal things that kids should be touching and feeling and smelling and manipulating. And so often that's not really what we see in daycares or preschool programs. It's very limited. They discourage those sorts of things. They don't have them doing little hands-on art projects. And I don't mean anything cute to take home to mommy. I mean that shaving cream or Cool Whip on the table sort of thing, so that they're really desensitizing and experiencing all those things. And that's kind of rare because it's messy and it's a problem.
Yeah. It's a pain for the adult. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. It takes some effort to plan it. It takes more effort to do it with the kids and even more effort to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and while I understand that, I still think, all kids need that stuff. All kids do, not just those sensory kids. All kids need that. And the other one, Laura, I want to get this out because I didn't get to say it last week, and we're getting short on time. It's gone by quickly once again. Laura talked about, when might you want to call an OT or look into getting an OT assessment, with your child. The other thing is a little precautionary note about talking to pediatricians about sensory issues. There are certainly pediatricians out there who are very knowledgeable about sensory integration or sensory processing disorders. But then, on the other hand, there are quite a few who are not.
Right.
Really kind of something that's relatively new as far as being that there's been much research or information even available. And I think a lot of times pediatricians who don't know much about it kind of reduce some of the behaviors that parents might describe to them as just being a spoiled brat or, he's just a normal boy. And, on a small scale, not very exaggerated situation, that might be true, but with the kids we're talking about who do clearly have sensory processing issues, it's really much more than that. So if you're living with one of those kids that you're saying, ding, 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 that's what this is, that's why my life is so difficult, because they have these sensory processing issues, your pediatrician may or may not know much of anything about that. And he may or she might be a great pediatrician, but that just might not be something that they really know very much about. So even if your pediatrician looks at you like you're crazy, don't let that be a stumbling block to getting that OT assessment. If in your heart of hearts you feel like, this is it, I know this is something I'm dealing with, move beyond the pediatrician. And, eventually they may learn this or they may not. But it's important that you know that not all pediatricians are necessarily aware of these issues. That's my thing I wanted to be able to say.
Well, and I think that's a great point. And, I treat lots of doctor's kids. I have, at any given time, sometimes even half my, 25, 30 caseload, have parents who are physicians. And so many times we just think because a person has MD after their name that it's an end-all, be-all expert in all things related to being a kid. Their training really is based on the medical stuff. And so much of the developmental stuff, they might recognize or not. But you really need to follow your instincts. And if you feel like it's a problem with your child, you are the expert on your kid. And then you need to go and get help from somebody else who can help you. You may want to still keep that pediatrician because he or she may be terrific with those medical issues, but don't let them blow you off about developmental things, and especially about something as maybe as uncommon to a pediatrician as sensory processing disorder. It is a very real condition, and it can totally affect your kid's development in lots of other ways. So you want to be persistent and find yourself some good help. If your kid is birth to three, the best way to get help for him is through your state early intervention program, and you can find information about that by just doing Google or another search engine and typing your state's name in plus the phrase early intervention. And you should be linked or find a link to your state program. In some states, those are done through the school districts, the public schools, but in some states, they're, like our state, Kentucky, it's a whole different departmental cabinet through the state. So you're going to want to do that. If your child is older than three, a good place to start would be by looking in the blue pages of your phone book and looking up your public school district and getting an assessment. And calling them and saying, I want to bring my kid in for an overall developmental assessment. These are some issues that we're having, especially if they're pretty severe and relate to his development overall, like talking, walking, learning, those kinds of things. And then if those aren't good options for you, you might look at your insurance coverage and see what plans or what your plan recommends, who the providers are on there. The other thing would be finding a university program or a children's hospital so that you could take your child in to be evaluated by an occupational therapist. But again, I love your point about not letting the pediatrician just blow those concerns off, because again, you know your kid and you know when something's not right. So follow those instincts and go ahead and have a therapist with them.
Right.
Oh, I was just going to say, last week I promised to get those resources on the website at teachmetotalk.com, and I didn't do that. But this weekend I'm going to get the sensory article completed with the references that we've been using. And again, the main thing that we used today was from that sensory-processing-disorder.com site and also Lucy Jane Miller's wonderful book, Sensational Kids. Those are great resources for parents who are just wanting to find out information. And you need to just, if you think this is an issue for your kid, you need to make yourself an expert and then find professionals who will help you figure out what's going on with your child.
Troubleshoot about what you can do in your normal daily routine that'll make life easier for the child and for you.
So. Yeah, and you're not going to want to just stop at that assessment. Again, like Kate said, you want to persist and say, okay, he's got this, he's tactile sensitive, he's orally defensive. What does that mean? Give me real-life ways every day that I can work on these kinds of things at home. And through treatment, the great thing is the earlier you catch these things, the better off your kid's going to be long-term developmentally.
Laura?
Yeah?
Oh, I thought you clicked off.
It's
kind of cut in a couple times. But anyway.
Oh,
we're going to close off here.
We're done. I think so. Well, thanks so much for listening today about sensory processing issues in young children. In a couple of weeks, we think that we've got one of our occupational therapy peers talking to coming on and talking to us about maybe more clinical treatments like the brushing protocol and listening therapy and those kinds of things that you might want more information about for your children. But look for that in a couple of weeks. Thanks, Kay.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.